His name was Amshat Bahal Zoon. He lived on the raft with his three wives and three children. He was a liar. What always annoyed the enemies of the Zoon tribe was not simply their honesty, which was infuriatingly absolute, but their total directness of approach. The Zoons had never heard about a euphemism and wouldn't understand what to do with it if they had one, except that they would certainly have called it a nice way of saying something nasty. Their rigid adherence to the truth was apparently not enjoined on them by a god, as is usually the case, but appeared to have a genetic base. The average Zoon could no more tell a lie than breathe underwater, and in fact, the very concept was enough to upset them considerably. Telling a lie meant no less than totally altering the universe. This was something of a drawback to a trading race, and so, over the millennia, the elders of the Zoon studied this strange power that everyone else had in such abundance, and decided that they should possess it too. Young men who showed faint signs of having such talent were encouraged, on special ceremonial occasions, to bend the truth even further on a competitive basis. The first recorded Zoon proto-lie was, "Actually, my grandfather is quite tall." But eventually they got the hang of it, and the office of tribal liar was instituted. It must be understood that while the majority of Zoon cannot lie, they have great respect for any Zoon who can say that the world is other than it is, and the liar holds a position of considerable eminence. He represents his tribe in all his dealings with the outside world, which the average Zoon long ago gave up trying to understand. Zoon tribes are very proud of their liars. Other races get very annoyed about all this. They feel that the Zoon ought to have adopted more subtle titles, like diplomat or public relations officer. They feel that they are poking fun at the whole thing. "Is all that true?" said Esk suspiciously, looking around the barge's crowded cabin.
"No," said Amshat firmly.
His junior wife, who was cooking porridge over a tiny ornate stove, giggled. His three children watched Esk solemnly over the edge of the table.
"Don't you ever tell the truth?"
"Do you?"
Amshat grinned his goldmine grin, but his eyes were not smiling.
"Why do I find you on my fleeces? Amshat is no kidnapper. There will be people at home who will worry, yes, no?"
"I expect Granny will come looking for me," said Esk. "But I don't think she will worry much. Just be angry, I expect. Anyway, I'm going to Ankh-Morpork. You can put me off the ship
boat,
if you like. I don't mind about the pike."
"I can't do that," said Amshat.
"Was that a lie?"
"No. This is wild country around us. Robbers and things."
Esk nodded brightly.
"That's settled then," she said. "I don't mind sleeping in the fleeces, and I can pay my way. I can do..."
She hesitated. Her unfinished sentence hung like a little curl of crystal in the air, while discretion made a successful bid for control of her tongue.
"Helpful things," she finished lamely.
She was aware that Amshat was looking slightly sideways at his senior wife, who was sewing by the stove. By Zoon tradition, she wore nothing but black. Granny would have thoroughly approved.
"What sort of helpful things?" he asked. "Washing and sweeping, yes, no?"
"If you like," said Esk. "Or distillation using the bifold or triple alembic, the making of varnishes, glazes, creams, zumchats and poons, the rendering of waxes, the manufacture of candles, the proper selection of seeds, roots and cuttings, and most preparations from the 80 marvellous herbs. I can spin, card, ret, fallow and weave on the hand, frame, harp, and noble looms, and I can knit if people can start the wool on for me. I can read soil and rock, do carpentry up to the three-way mortise and tenon, predict weather by means of beast sign and sky wreck, make increase in bees, brew 5 types of mead, make dyes and mordants and pigments, including a fast blue. I can do most types of white smithing, mend boots, cure and fashion most leathers, and if you've got any goats, I can look after them. I like goats.
Amshat looked at her thoughtfully. She felt she was expected to continue.
Granny never likes to see people sitting around doing nothing, she offered. She always says a girl who is good with her hands will never want for a living, she added, by way of further explanation.
Or the husband, I expect, nodded Amshat weakly.
Actually, Granny has a lot to say about that.
I bet she did, said Amshat.
He looked at the senior wife, who nodded almost imperceptibly.
Very well, he said. If you can make yourself useful, you can stay. And you can play a musical instrument?
Esk returned his steady gaze, not batting an eyelid.
Probably.
And so Esk, with the minimum of difficulty and only a little regret, left the Ramtops and their weather and joined the Zunes on their great trading journey down the Ankh. There were at least 30 barges, with at least one sprawling Zune family on each, and no two vessels appeared to be carrying the same cargo. Most of them were strung together, and the Zunes simply hauled on the cable and stepped onto the next deck if they fancied a bit of socialising. Esk set up home in the fleeces. It was warm, smelled slightly of Granny's cottage, and much more important, meant that she was undisturbed. She was getting a bit worried about magic. It was definitely getting out of control. She wasn't doing magic. It was just happening around her. And she sensed that people probably wouldn't be too happy if they knew. It meant that if she washed up, she had to clatter and splash at length to conceal the fact that the dishes were cleaning themselves. If she did some darning, she had to do it on some private part of the deck to conceal the fact that the edges of the hole raveled themselves together as if by magic. Then she woke up on the second day of her voyage to find that several of the fleeces around the spot where she had hidden the staff had combed, carded, and spun themselves into neat skeins during the night. She put all thoughts of lighting fires out of her head. There were compensations, though. Every sluggish turn of the great brown river brought new scenes. There were dark stretches hemmed with deep forest, through which the barge travelled in the dead centre of the river with the men armed and the women below, except for Esk, who sat listening with interest to the snortings and sneezings that followed them through the bushes on the bank. There were stretches of farmland. There were several towns much larger than Ohulan. There were even some mountains, although they were old and flat and not young and frisky like her mountains. Not that she was homesick, exactly, but sometimes she felt like a boat herself, drifting on the edge of an infinite rope, but always attached to an anchor. The barges stopped at some of the towns. By tradition, only the men went ashore, and only Amshat, wearing his ceremonial lying hat, spoke to non-Zunes. Esk usually went with him. He tried hinting that she should obey the unwritten rule of Zune life and stay afloat, but a hint was to Esk what a mosquito bite was to the average rhino, because she was already learning that if you ignore the rules, people will, half the time, quietly rewrite them so that they don't apply to you. Anyway, it seemed to Amshat that when Esk was with him, he always got a very good price. There was something about a small child squinting determinedly at them from behind his legs that made even market-hardened merchants hastily conclude their business. In fact, it began to worry him when a market broker in the walled town of Zemphis offered him a bag of ultramarines in exchange for 100 fleeces. A voice from the level of his pocket said, "They're not ultramarines."
"Listen to the child," said the broker, grinning.
Amshat solemnly held one of the stones to his eyes. "I am listening," he said. "And they do indeed look like ultramarines.
They have the gilt and shimmy. Esk shook her head.
They're just sparkles, she said.
She said it without thinking and regretted it immediately as both men turned to stare at her. Amshat turned the stone over in his palm, putting the chameleon spiracle stones into a box with some real gems so that they appeared to change their hue was a traditional trick. But these had a true inner blue fire. He looked up sharply at the broker. Amshat had been finely trained in the art of the lie. He recognized the subtle signs now he came to think about it. There seems to be a doubt, he said. But it's easily resolved. We need only take them to the assayer in Pine Street, because the world knows that sparacles will dissolve in hypactic fluid, yes, no? The broker hesitated. Amshat had changed position slightly, and the set of his muscles suggested that any sudden movement on the broker's part would see him flat in the dust. And that damn child was squinting at him as though she could see through to the back of his mind. His nerve broke.
I regret this unfortunate dispute, he said. I had accepted the stones as ultramarines in good faith, but rather than cause disharmony between us, I will ask you to accept them as a gift, and for the fleeces, may I offer this roseate of the first sorting?
He took a small red stone from a tiny velvet pouch. Amshat hardly looked at it, but without taking his eyes off the man, passed it down to Esk. She nodded. When the merchant had hurried off, Amshat took Esk's hand and half-dragged her to the assayer's stall, which was little more than a niche in the wall. The old man took the smallest of the blue stones, listened to Amshat's hurried explanation, poured out a saucerful of hypactic fluid, and dropped the stone in. It frothed into nothingness.
Very interesting, he said.
He took another stone in a tweezer and examined it under the glass.
These are indeed spiracles, but remarkably fine specimens in their own right, he concluded. They are by no means worthless, and I, for example, would be prepared to offer you... Is there something wrong with that little girl's eyes?
Amshat nudged Esk, who stopped trying out another look.
I would offer you, shall we say, 2 zats of silver.
Shall we say 5? Said Amshat pleasantly. And I would like to keep one of the stones, said Esk. The old man threw up his hands.
But they're mere curios, he said. Of value only to a collector.
A collector may yet sell them to an unsuspecting purchaser as finest roseates or ultramarines, said Amshat, especially if he was the only assayer in town. The assayer grumbled a bit at this, but at last they settled on 3 zats and one of the spiracles on a thin silver chain for Esk. When they were out of earshot, Amshat handed her the tiny silver coins and said, These are yours. You have earned them. But he hunkered down so that his eyes were on a level with hers. You must tell me how you knew the stones were false. He looked worried, but Esk sensed that he wouldn't really like the truth. Magic made people uncomfortable. He wouldn't like it if she said simply, Spiracles are spiracles, and ultramarines are ultramarines, and though you may not think they look the same, that is because most people don't use their eyes in the right way. Nothing can entirely disguise its true nature. Instead, she said, The dwarfs mine spiracles near the village where I was born, and you soon learn to see how they bend light in a funny way. Amshat looked into her eyes for some time, then he shrugged.
Okay, he said. Fine. Well, I have some further business here. Why don't you buy yourself some new clothes or something? I'd warn you against unscrupulous traders, but somehow, I don't know, I don't think you will have any trouble.
Esk nodded. Amshat strode off through the marketplace,
At the first corner he turned, looked at her thoughtfully, and then disappeared among the crowds.
"Well, that's the end of sailing," Esk told herself.
"He's not quite sure, but he's going to be watching me now, and before I know what's happening, the staff will be taken away, and there will be all sorts of trouble. Why does everyone get so upset about magic?"
She gave a philosophical sigh and set about exploring the possibilities of the town. There was the question of the staff, though. Esk had rammed it deep among the fleeces, which were not going to be unloaded yet. If she went back for it, people would start asking questions, and she didn't know the answers. She found a convenient alleyway and scuttled down it until a deep doorway gave her the privacy she required. If going back was out of the question, then only one thing remained. She held out a hand and closed her eyes. She knew exactly what she wanted to do. It lay in front of her eyes. The staff mustn't come flying through the air, wrecking the barge and drawing attention to itself. All she wanted, she told herself, was for there to be a slight change in the way the world was organized. It shouldn't be a world where the staff was in the fleeces. It should be a world where it was in her hand. A tiny change, an infinitesimal alteration to the way things were. If Esk had been properly trained in wizardry, she would have known that this was impossible. All wizards knew how to move things about, starting with protons and working upwards. But the important thing about moving something from A to Z, according to basic physics, was that at some point it should pass through the rest of the alphabet. The only way one could cause something to vanish at A and appear at Z would be to shuffle the whole of reality sideways. The problems this would cause didn't bear thinking about. Esk, of course, had not been trained, and it is well known that a vital ingredient of success is not knowing that what you're attempting can't be done. A person ignorant of the possibility of failure can be a half-brick in the path of the bicycle of history. As Esk tried to work out how to move the staff, the ripples spread out in the magical ether, changing the Discworld in thousands of tiny ways. Most went entirely unnoticed. Perhaps a few grains of sand lay on their beaches in a slightly different position, or the occasional leaf hung on its tree in a marginally different way. But then the wavefront of probability struck the edge of reality and rebounded like the slosh off the side of the pond, which, meeting the laggard ripples coming the other way, caused small but important whirlpools in the very fabric of existence. You can have whirlpools in the fabric of existence, because it's a very strange fabric. Esk was completely ignorant of all this, of course, but was quite satisfied when the staff dropped out of thin air into her hand. It felt warm. She looked at it for some time. She felt that she ought to do something about it. It was too big, too distinctive, too inconvenient. It attracted attention. "If I'm taking you to Ankh Morpork," she said thoughtfully, "you've got to go in disguise." A few late flickers of magic played around the staff, and then it went dark. Eventually, Esk solved the immediate problem by finding a store in the main Zemphis marketplace that sold broomsticks, buying the largest, carrying it back to her doorway, removing the handle and ramming the staff deep into the birch twigs. It didn't seem right to treat a noble object in this way, and she silently apologized to it. It made a difference, anyway. No one looked twice at a small girl carrying a broom. She brought a spice pasty to eat while exploring. The stallholder carelessly shortchanged her, and only realized later that he had inexplicably handed over 2 silver pieces. Also, rats mysteriously got in and ate all his stock during the night. And his grandmother was struck by lightning. The town was smaller than Ohulin, and very different because it lay on the junction of 3 trade routes, quite apart from the river itself. It was built around 1 enormous square, which was a cross between a permanent exotic traffic jam and a tent village. Camels kicked mules, mules kicked horses, horses kicked camels, and they all kicked humans. There was a riot of colour. a din of noise, a nasal orchestration of smells, and the steady, heady sounds of hundreds of people working hard and making money. One of the reasons for the bustle was that over large parts of the continent, other people preferred to make money without working at all. And since the disc had yet to develop a music recording industry, they were forced to fall back on older, more traditional forms of banditry. Strangely enough, these often involved considerable effort. Rolling heavy rocks to the top of cliffs for a decent ambush, cutting down trees to block the road, and digging a pit lined with spikes while still keeping a wicked edge on a dagger probably involved a much greater expenditure of thought and muscle than more socially acceptable professions, but nevertheless, there were still people misguided enough to endure all this, plus long nights in uncomfortable surroundings, merely to get their hands on perfectly ordinary large boxes of jewels. So a town like Zemphis was the place where caravans split, mingled, and came together again, as dozens of merchants and travellers banded together for protection against the socially disadvantaged on the trails ahead. Esk, wandering unregarded amidst the bustle, learned all this by the simple method of finding someone who looked important and tugging on the hem of his coat. This particular man was counting bales of tobacco and would have succeeded but for the interruption.
What?
I said, what's happening here? The man meant to say, push off and bother someone else. He meant to give her a light cuff about the head, so he was astonished to find himself bending down and talking seriously to a small, grubby-faced child holding a large broomstick, which also, it seemed to him later, was in some indefinable way paying attention. He explained about the caravans. The child nodded. People all get together to travel?
Precisely.
Where to?
All sorts of places. Stolart, Pseudopolis, Ankh-Morpork, of course. But the river goes there, said Esk reasonably. Barges, the Zunes.
Ah, yes, said the merchant. But they charge high prices and they can't carry everything, and anyway no one trusts them much.
But they're very honest.
Yes. But you know what they say. Never trust an honest man.
He smiled knowingly. Who says that?
They do. You know.
People, he said, a certain uneasiness entering his voice.
Oh, said Esk. She thought about it. They must be very silly, she said primly.
Thank you, anyway. He watched her wander off and got back to his counting. A moment later there was another tug at his coat.
57, 57, 57, 57. Well?
He was trying not to lose his place. Sorry to bother you again, said Esk, but those bale things...
What about them, 57, 57, 57, 57?
Well, are they supposed to have little white worm things in them?
What?
The merchant lowered his slate and stared at Esk.
What little worms?
Wiggly ones, white, added Esk helpfully. All sort of burrowing about in the middle of the bales.
You mean tobacco thread worm?
He looked wild-eyed at the stack of bales being unloaded by, now he came to think about it, a vendor with the nervous look of a midnight sprite who wants to get away before you find out what fairy gold turns into in the morning.
But he told me these had been well stored and... How do you know, anyway?
The child had disappeared among the crowds. The merchant looked hard at the spot where she had been. He looked hard at the vendor who was grinning nervously. He looked hard at the sky. Then he took his sampling knife out of his pocket, stared at it for a moment, appeared to reach a decision, and sidled towards the nearest bale. Esk, meanwhile, had by random eavesdropping found the caravan being assembled for Ankh-Morpork. The trail boss was sitting at a table made up of a plank across two barrels. He was busy. He was talking to a wizard. Seasoned travellers know that a party setting out to cross possibly hostile country should have a fair number of swords in it, but should definitely have a wizard in case there was any need for magic arts, and even if these do not become necessary, for lighting fires. A wizard of the third rank or above does not expect to pay for the privilege of joining the party. Rather, he expects to be paid. Delicate negotiations were even now coming to a conclusion.
Fair enough, Master Treacle, but what of the young man?
Said the trail boss, one Adab Gander, an impressive figure in a troll-hide jerkin, rakishly floppy hat, and a leather kilt.
He's no wizard, I can see.
He's in training,
said Treacle, a tall, skinny wizard whose robes declared him to be a mage of the ancient and truly original Brothers of the Silver Star, one of the eight orders of wizardry.
Then no wizard he, said Gander. I know the rules, and you're not a wizard unless you've got a staff, and he hasn't.
Even now he travels to the Unseen University for that small detail, said Treacle loftily. Wizards parted with money slightly less readily than tigers parted with their teeth. Gander looked at the lad in question. He had met a good many wizards in his time and considered himself a good judge, and he had to admit that this boy looked like good wizard material. In other words, he was thin, gangling, pale from reading disturbing books in unhealthy rooms, and had watery eyes like two lightly poached eggs. It crossed Gander's mind that one must speculate in order to accumulate. All he needs to get right to the top, he thought, is a bit of a handicap. Wizards are martyrs to things like asthma and flat feet. It somehow seemed to give them their drive.
"What's your name, lad?"
he said, as kindly as possible. "Amon," said the boy. His Adam's apple bobbed like a captive balloon. He turned to his companion full of mute appeal.
"Simon,"
said Treacle.
"Amon,"
agreed Simon thankfully.
"Can you cast fireballs or whirling spells such as might be hurled against an enemy?"
Simon looked sideways at Treacle. He ventured.
"My young friend follows higher magic than the mere hurling of sorceries," said the wizard.
"Oh,"
said Simon. Gander nodded.
"Well," he said, "maybe you will indeed be a wizard, lad. Maybe when you have your fine staff, you'll consent to travel with me one time, yes? I will make an investment in you, yes?" "Just nod," said Gander, who was not a naturally cruel man.
Simon nodded gratefully. Treacle and Gander exchanged nods, and then the wizard strode off, with his apprentice trailing behind him under a weight of baggage. Gander looked down at a list in front of him and carefully crossed out, "Wizard."